All right, welcome to Good Areas Podcast. Jared Kimber here, live for the second time today. I think this is my last podcast of the day. I haven't looked at my schedule. There's lots of children around. Not even just mine. Not even just children I know. It's just a lot of children around. So if you hear screaming in the background, it's probably that. If you want to support us on the Wagon Wheel Podcast, the podcast where we answer your questions on cricket, the best way to do it if you're watching live is to come onto YouTube and do a super chat. Even if you don't do a super chat, you know, comment, like, subscribe, do all those magical things. But if you're desperate for a question and you realize that we don't always record these at the same time, the third best way of doing this is by supporting us on Patreon. So Good Areas Podcast on Patreon, please support us there. It is the sort of the backbone of everything that is the Good Areas Network comes from that. Let's start today with Sashimi, who says, in the NBA, everyone knew the number one draft pick would be Cooper Flagg. If there was a cricket draft, who would be your number one? Obviously, he can't have played international cricket. I don't know who it would be, Sashimi. Because the thing is, if this was a thing, I'd be really interested in it and look at it. But it's not a thing. So I'm not really, I don't watch much under-19s cricket. It's not something that I have to worry about. Yeah, I mean, if you're doing a draft of what, under 22, under 23, you probably have Marco Janssen and Jaiswal would be close to one and two, wouldn't they? I'm trying to think of anyone else out there. Can't think of too many other players off the top of my head that would be high up. But yeah, there's no industry behind it. One of the reasons that everyone knew that Cooper Flagg was going to be the number one pick in a draft is because there's a whole industry about it, right? There's, you know, people are looking into it and everything else. And the draft is, it's almost as big as the finals. I mean, you get a finals like last year where you have two small market teams. It's like the draft is probably takes up more space than the actual NBA finals do. So yeah, it's very weird from that perspective, but that's how it goes in a sport like that. But also NFL, baseball, all those things, they're very interested in that. We don't really do that in cricket, partly because it isn't part of our long history or culture. So yeah, if you're asking me to pick someone who hasn't played yet, I don't know. Trying to think of like just a random name of a very good younger player I've heard of. Someone was telling me about someone last week. No, I got no one. I've got absolutely nothing on that one. Arvind says, do you have a thing in test cricket that really gets your juices flowing? Like for me, it's when the ball suddenly is reverse swinging. Ooh. I do like a bit of inconsistent bounce because it's the one thing that we don't really get white ball cricket and T20 cricket. Like sometimes you get a white ball pitch and you'd be like, oh, this wicket's a bit two-paced or, you know, maybe a little bit more towards bowlers, but you don't really see it dramatically. I like a P-roller. I like the ball sort of shooting up towards the end of the game. I don't like it early on. Obviously, that would be kind of ruins the game, but I do like it towards the end of the game when it should be very different. The skills that needed to be a successful test batter at the end of the game should be very different. And the same with bowling, I suppose, of how you go about it. So yeah, I think that'd probably be something for me would be that sort of, you know what the pitch is doing, it's making slight changes, and it's like, now how are you going to handle the ball rolling along the ground, or how are you going to handle it shooting up, or whatever that may be. Maybe even just, I'd take it a step further and say, you know, dramatic changes in pitch. Like the Old Trafford one was actually a really good example of this because I think India made a pretty decent total considering the conditions they went in. And then within about half an hour, I was like, oh, this pitch has changed massively now. And through no fault of their own, that's going to be, even if they made an extra 100 runs, I was like, that's not going to be enough. Lemon says, why didn't Nathan Ellis play for CSK last year, especially since they were struggling? I don't know. It's really weird. Nathan Ellis has become this like perpetual bench guy. I'd have to go back and think about their entire bowling. I think at a certain point, they pivoted so early to sort of a rebuild. Is it worth bowling Nathan Ellis? I can't remember if me and Robbie talked about this or I was talking about it with someone else, but there is an argument that everyone knows what Nathan Ellis is going to do. They probably maybe could have been a little bit more sure of him. I think their issues were, and I'm trying to think back to what their bowling issues were, but he's the sort of bowler that is very good in a good team. So if he comes in and he plays for Australia, for instance, or in a good Big Bash side, he's very important because you're keeping the game quite close all the way through. And then you get to the end and, at the end of a game, you suddenly have this control right? That's what he gives you. He, you know, more than anything else, he gives you control on the back end of T20 games. That wasn't really their concern, was it? So perhaps they were trying other things, but it's not the first time he's done that. That's why I sort of say he's this perpetual bench guy, right? Where they just like, we really like Nathan Ellis to be here. Whether we want to play him or not, I don't know. So, yeah, I've always found that a bit odd. But I think teams think he doesn't have a high upside, but he also probably has a low or a high floor, if that makes sense. Get that right one day. Neil says, interesting video on coaching, becoming service. But what is the job of a coach at top international team? So Gambia seems to try and pick the 11, tries to instill his philosophy and isn't interested in the data. McDonald seems to... seems like he's there to do whatever Cummins wants him to do. Baz is a hype master supporting. Yeah. Yeah. So there's lots of different kinds. I don't think there is, one particular role of a coach or one sort of style of coach. My issue with Gambia when they brought him in is I kind of thought they were about to go through a transition, which I suppose we all know, I know they have gone through, right? And so did you need a more educational / skills-based coach? And he seems to be more of an authoritarian style, strategic type coach. So this is just from knowing him from the outside. You know, he might be brilliant with education and everything else. But I think that the best question is usually what kind of coach you want. And if you go back to all the stuff I said about Gambia, pro and anti, because I didn't think this would be a particularly successful appointment, partly because I just thought they were going through a bunch of tough tours and they were going to have to, you know, rejig on the fly. But I did think that there was an element of, he might have been the wrong man at the wrong time, but maybe they were thinking that he could be a very good sort of motivational, loud room in the voice for the future generation. We still don't know about that. So that's probably still a step or two away from where we are at the moment of knowing how he is with all those sorts of things. We've seen already that the comment he made the other day is one of the more bizarre comments. It's just not how professional sport works. And he knows that, but that's a completely different argument for another day. But yeah, so you know, and you talk about McDonald there to do whatever Cummins wants to do. I don't think that's Andrew McDonald's personality at all. I think Andrew McDonald is the sort of person who is very much a player's coach, but he's very much in charge, right? And I think him and Cummins work together, which is very different to some other coaches like to work on their own. McCullum and Stokes very much work together, right? That isn't the case with every single, you know, coach and captain relationship. Sometimes the coach is in charge. Sometimes the captain is in charge. So you have all these different things. So it's more about what you're looking for. But all coaches can do a little bit of technical stuff. All coaches can do a little bit of strategy. All coaches can be the hype person when they need to be, the arm around the shoulder, the father figure, whatever that may be. But it's kind of how we view them and you know, what the future of this is. And I just think that you have to match the coach to the team. And looking at the way they did their process, the BCCI, my worry from the start was that they didn't do that. And they went through famous names until they got a famous name who said yes. That's a chance it will still work because this is a really good side and it's hard to bugger it up over a long period. But it was a tricky period to take over. I just think that's the absolutely wrong way to do anything like this. Have you thought about a podcast with Paddy Upton or Mickey Arthur? I think I had asked Paddy Upton on a podcast. And I think, oh no, maybe it wasn't Paddy Upton. No, actually, I don't think I did ask Paddy Upton. Maybe I had to reach out to him for a piece. I can't remember. Mickey Arthur, yeah, I know Mickey a little bit. We've commentated a couple of games together. A really nice guy. Yeah, I probably should get him on a podcast. I've got a list of about 8 people who've said yes to Red Inkers, and I haven't even organized a time or date for them yet. So it's just a lot of this is just a little bit further behind than I should be. Sam says, who's cricket's Matt Letizia? Who is Matt Letizia? I thought Matt Letizia was a rugby player. Is there a rugby player with a similar name to Matt Letizia that I'm like confusing him with? But it says here, a top player for a lower-end Premier League team who regularly won goal of the week, really good international caps, and it's turned into a right-wing conspiracy nut job in retirement. I don't know. The latter one, is Mark Richardson? I don't know if he's a right... wing conspiracy nut job. He certainly went right wing, but he might have always been right wing. We're just talking about Gambia. Is Rodney Hogg the Matt Letizia? I don't know. I don't really know enough about Matt Letizia to make any of these comments. Nadika says, say you know what you know now, and are transported in 2014, alternate world, where the only difference is that Test cricket is franchise competition and you are GM. You can sign Smudge or Jadeja for 10 years at the same cost. Oh, Jadeja. Yeah, I mean, we did that piece two or three years ago. I can't remember if it was me and Cheyenne or it was before Cheyenne, but that was my big thing of I thought Jadeja was the most useful player in the world at that time. And if you were doing a draft of players from then, and I think me and I think Harmy said a similar thing even the other day on one of the videos that we did. So yeah, without doubt, because he allows you to play an extra batter or bowler in any game that you want to play. And Smith doesn't do that, right? The versatility that Jadeja gives you, like I think you can make an argument between Smith and Stokes, right? Stokes isn't always bowling, and he's, you know, if he's a specialist batter, you know, his stats aren't always at that level that they would need to be for a specialist batter and all that. I think you make really good arguments there. You might still go with Stokes, but you can make those arguments. Jadeja, you don't have to pick another spinner for the next 10 years, and he's going to be really, really good at that. And he can bat as high as five in a pinch, right? And also could probably bat as low as eight if you wanted to do something else. The flexibility he gives you in your side, Smith does not give you any flexibility. Smith gives you great batting. Also, I would generally just pick a great bowler. Like, I'm not sure Smith would be my second pick either. I would probably be picking, well, 10 years ago, I suppose. I'm trying to think who would. Hazelwood, I suppose, because Cummins was kind of injured at the time, wasn't he? So you'd be picking Hazelwood, Rabada. Was that Rabada 2014? Was he just after that when he really broke through? But yeah, Hazelwood would have been a pretty good pick at that stage. Maybe you would have had Mitchell Starc as well, because a little bit of extra batting. Ashwin would have been really high up on my list as well. Although once I had Jadeja, probably maybe slightly less. Sandeep says, really enjoying TalkSport commentary. Just wish TalkSport enables the feed in an app like SEN does with the sync. So they do have that facility, but that is for the radio, I believe. I'm not an expert with all this sort of stuff. This isn't a radio broadcast, it's a YouTube broadcast. So it has to be on YouTube, and it has to be geo-blocked the way that it is, as I understand it. That's the rights of the conditions. So it's very different than a standard radio one. Can you break down a typical day inside the commentary box? Was people moaning like any other workplace in the world? How does a broadcast feed on a monitor differ from home? We don't get a broadcast feed. Generally, we might get what's called a fruit machine, although we haven't had one in this series, and I don't know if John's or maybe you have to pay extra for it. Different broadcasters like them. A fruit machine gives you lots of stats and information on the screen at all times, kind of a bit small. All the TV companies have them. Not all radios do. We certainly had fruit machines on some commentary stints I've had and on others, but you probably Google cricket fruit machine and you'll see what it is. It's things like time since last boundary, and it's just got extra information than you see on it. That everything else, though, is TV. We didn't even have the TV for like half of day one. I don't think we had a TV at all in Edgbaston, so we only had the big screen. How often does a producer or his staff step in with stats? A producer would never step in with stats. That's a stats person, which is a different role. He's just, the way that we do it is Gary Morgan is our statistician, and he just, anytime he's got anything interesting, because he's scoring all the time, obviously, and doing his stats all the time, he's just putting it in the group. What else? Talking points. Producer with talking points. Yeah, little things. I mean, especially if you're producing and you can see they've missed something. So you got to understand that radio commentary is really weird, because you're trying to continue a conversation. It's very different than TV. And so it's very hard to do that and pick up that there's a conversation happening over here, or someone's being thrown out of the ground, or the umpires or whatever. Like, you might be caught in a conversation, so producers will come in at certain points. Talking points, probably less so, just that it probably more a situation before you go on air, producer might say, do you know about this? Or everyone's talking about this. And sometimes if there's a really interesting conversation happening or a theme that you're covering, the producer might say, just so you know, this is what we've been talking about. So it gives you a little bit of other heads up, but you're not in there listening, right? Harmy sometimes will be, but me and Manners are usually back in the press box. John is generally halfway between both, I suppose. But yeah, you know, radio commentary is a conversation, so it's not really about stats or special angles or anything like that. It's about a conversation around the game. And so it flows in a different pattern, I think, than TV commentary probably. Well, it definitely flows in a different way. Who was it the other day? Someone was, a former player was telling me that like they'd only done a little bit of radio and they were like, I'm so much more natural on this than I am on the TV. And you find that a lot when people do radio. All right, quick break here on Good Areas Live, the Wagon Wheel Show, and we'll be back after this. I once made a pair in a club game, which is almost impossible to do. But I have been obsessed with batting my entire life. And so I put that into my new book, The Art of Batting. Being that I'm not very good at that skill, I decided to talk to other people who were. So I hit up as many contacts as I could just to talk about batting. Rahul Dravid, Brian Lara, AB de Villiers, Kumar Sangakkara, Ross Taylor, Susie Bates, Nasser Hussain, Ian Chappell, and so many, many, many more. I wanted batters to talk about how they and their friends made runs, because that is the art of batting. Mob says, from what you've shared with us, you seem like wonderful parents creating a great environment for raising kids. I mean, my kids might disagree. What aspects of cricket do you integrate into your parenting style? For example, do you have sabermetrics around school drop-off? Or is there an... Oh, no, we lost the end of his question. Don't know if I can... Rakshit's not here. I wonder if he just missed that. No, certainly no... I think I had this up before because there was a question that came in. Or is there any ethos, mentality, tactic that crosses over for you? Oh, that's interesting. There are things that I keep stats on. There was a toilet... situation where, you know, one of the children was having issues with, I can't remember what it was, but something around toilets. And so over a long period of time, I kept stats on that so we could understand if what we were doing was having any impact or not. So there have been times when I have kept stats on my children too, so that, because otherwise it's like every time something goes wrong, you're like, oh, this always happens. And you're like, but does this always happen? Or is it getting better, right? Like simple things like that. Also, it's little wins for the kids to show them that they're getting better at things. I can't think of too many other times I've used stats specifically. I'm trying to work out if there is another time when that happens. Or I mean, I'm sure there are, but maybe not as much. Sorry, there's a weird message on my screen that I need to send to my team. I can't think of too many other times when I've had to use stats, but I'm sure there are probably others. And I suppose in family life, home life, like quite often I will run the numbers on stuff just to get a better idea on stuff. And, you know, my wife's really good at sort of a more traditional research, you know, as a lawyer and everything. So between the two of us, one of us is probably going to come up with something. I think one thing that I would try and that I try and tell my kids a lot is that, you know, cricket sort of shows that you can have, you know, if you look at Shubman Gill's stats recently, he comes in and he's actually doing okay in Test cricket in what is a hard period for Test cricket. And then he sort of has a bit of a drop for a little while and people sort of lose interest in him. And then, of course, now he's on this big up curve. And it's one thing that you sort of, that as a, if you're a sports fan who kind of pays attention to these sorts of things the way that I am, it's a really, really good conversation to have with a kid and be like, look, you're trying really hard and today you're worse than you were yesterday. Overall though, you are hopefully moving into a situation where you will get better over a long period of time and that we're not expecting you to improve 1% each day. We're expecting over a period of time for there to be an improvement, but that doesn't mean that there won't also be a period where you don't improve and where you get worse at things, right? And I think that's probably one thing. And also I'm probably a bigger believer in, you know, processes and doing the right things, you know. So sometimes when one of my children is having trouble with something, I'll be like, okay, that's fine. But if we just get back to doing the right things over and over again, right, and we put things in the right place, eventually the results will come. If you get upset and think, oh, well, I was doing the right things for a little while and it didn't work anyway, and you go off and try and do something else, it's probably not going to work. Like if you're sure that your system and that your process is correct, then you should be following that through and seeing where that goes. So yeah, that's probably something else. I'm sure there's heaps of little things though, right? Like that I haven't really thought of. I think me and my wife are pretty good at staying quite level, you know, and ensuring that we don't get too high or too low on things. Because again, it's something that we've both noticed in professional things, of the people who get really high and really low, it's emotionally exhausting. It doesn't always help with the children and everything else. It's like, oh, you've done this thing. This is really cool. I really like what you've done here. I'm really proud of you. Well done. Rather than, oh my God, you're the best child I've ever seen. Like, you know, and the same as the opposite. And it can be tough. Sometimes you do get too high and sometimes you do get too low. But yeah, you know, it is what it is. Parenting is just, you're in process all the way through, I think. Ali says, despite calls by significant Indian fans and some cricketers to boycott all Pakistan matches, BCCI still went ahead and placed both India and Pakistan in the same group. Is this market forcing BCCI, or is it just an indicator that BCCI, BJP softening their public posture? Well, there's a bunch of different ways to look at this, Ali. Like, one would be, if they put themselves in the same group, maybe it has softened. The other one is, now they have to play each other, and therefore a boycott or pulling out of that game or whatever it may be is more dramatic, right? So I don't know. I thought the veterans, the Champions League of Masters, or whatever the hell it was called, I thought they put the players in a bad situation when we all knew that the players weren't going to be able to play in that, just because it wasn't worth them doing. Like, it was, you know, it was like when Piers Morgan asked me on his show after the Besto thing. It's a little bit of money, but it's not like life-changing money that he was going to pay me. And then I have to spend 3 weeks with people abusing me on Twitter for like a little bit of money. Like, what's the gain there, right? This is different. This is something that you can see real reasons why it can go ahead and real reasons why it won't. I'm not looking ahead at the moment to those sorts of things. Like, it's just not something I've even started factoring in. Aravind says, curious about what you think about Washington and Jadeja batting on for the hundreds despite England offering the draw. My thoughts are that they toughed it out to actually take India's safety, so they're well within their rights to actually get to the hundreds if that's what they wanted. Felt England's apparent indignation at the audacity of having someone continue to play was pretty funny. Part of me wanted to continue batting even after the hundreds. Yeah, I mean, I honestly couldn't give a shit if someone goes on to make the hundreds. So if that's all they were batting on for, I'm kind of like, all right, feel like you have to. But I also understand why batters feel like they have earned it. Like, whatever I might feel about this, we do live in a culture that does care about hundreds quite a lot, right? But I thought England was right to ask for the game to finish. I thought India was right to continue to bat. And I thought it would have been right if India would have batted for another 45 minutes, right? I would have had no issue with that. Like, but it's a 5-test series. You take whatever chance you can to make the opposition more tired, more angry, you know, more emotional. Whatever you can do, that's all part of it. So I had no real issue there. The hundreds thing, it's not for me, and this is not the only time I'm going to talk about it. It's really interesting, isn't it, though, that the last test, going for hundreds and talk about hundreds and thoughts about hundreds actually cost India. So, you know, you can say there's positive and negatives from that point of view. But yeah, as I said, I think I was thinking about this purely from a cricket point of view, which is probably different than a lot of other people who have national vested interest in it, and a lot of people who are just tired after 5 days. In my head, I was just like, just keep batting and make Jofra Archer stand up for another 45 minutes, or Ben Stokes stand up. That's the way I would have gone about it. But everyone is different when it comes to those sorts of things. Get rid of this stupid message. Okay. PJ says, Archie Lenham, Sussex leg spinner, what has happened to him? Plateaued, or does he join the long list of leg spinners that have an okay breakout season in T20 and then fizzle out into a 50 plus first class bowling average and largely forgotten about? My memory of Archie when I first saw him was that, so what I'm looking for in wrist spinners is like an ability to consistently land the ball in the right area. Just having a look at his overall record. Consistently land the ball in a right area because of biomechanics, right? So I don't care if he doesn't quite twist his hips correctly, because some leg spinners don't do that. Mushtaq Ahmed probably, and Abdul Qadir probably, maybe not quite as much as others. But I am hoping that he has a strong front arm, that he's biomechanically sound enough, because it's really, if you're not very biomechanically sound, whether you be front on or side on or whatever kind of leg spinner you are, it's very hard to land the ball in the same position over and over again. I felt with Archie when I had seen him, and he's only 21, so Kuldeep had this problem at not quite to this level, but I just felt that he didn't have the ability to consistently land the ball in the same spot over and over again. And if you don't have the ability to land the ball in the same spot over and over again, eventually I think that catches up to you. And I think that's really tough. That's what I thought at the time, but he's 21. He's got plenty of times to, you know, to change and everything else. So I wouldn't throw him away or anything. He can spin the ball and he's had some success and he should understand what it's like to be a professional now. This is probably the tough time in his career. And a lot of players don't come back from this. And then you get other players who do fight through. I mean, Shoaib Bashir, different kind of case, but, you know, literally what? Surrey was signing two or three off spinners and he was the third or fourth off spinner that didn't get picked. Very easy for him to go off and get a job at that point, right? And he didn't. Like, this is what being a professional athlete is about. PJ says, how would these players have done in the current IPL and modern T20 in general if they could have played during their peak? Ian Harvey, Lance Klusner, Chris Harris. Yeah, I mean, I've covered Klusner a lot before. If they're in their peak and nothing else has changed, as in the game is, if you just took him from his peak and put him in now, he'd still be a really good T20 player now. He would fit in. But if you're talking about how much more power he had compared to everyone else and his boundary options compared to everyone else, and he had those available to him now, then he would be a monster, right? And we've seen what he can do in the 99 World Cup when he's let off the leash, right? So he could be like that. I don't know if Varun has done stats on that, but I'm assuming, you know, I think he still had, I'm trying to remember if I'd looked this up before, because I get asked these kinds of questions quite a lot, but also we did that big video on him. He still played, yeah, he played 53 T20s when he was well beyond his peak. He averages 35 at a strike rate of 136. Struggled a little bit with the ball in those. By that stage, I would have thought he was largely beyond his best with the ball. So in his peak, he's probably a fifth bowler. A better fifth bowler than, say, Ben Stokes. Maybe a more useful fifth bowler than someone like Ravi Bopara or Jason Holder. Although, maybe not. Maybe he's more like a Jason Holder. I think you're expecting to get four overs a game out of Klusner. Two and a half to three overs a game. So maybe around that Jadeja level, right? Jadeja's more about matchups, but Klusner might be, when do you bowl him? I don't think there's a lot. I don't remember him being a great death bowler. But yeah, he could certainly be handy. And then with his batting, he'd probably be Klaassen, wouldn't he? Realistically. Klaassen with the ability to also open the batting if you needed him to. And probably with the flexibility that if he was in a really strong side, you could bat him further down the order. Like, his flexibility in his batting is, in T20, he could bat anywhere from 1 to 7. So he's a fascinating cricketer. I have travelled the cricketing world, and so I've collected two things, the phone numbers of random taxi drivers and overseas SIM cards. Rideshare apps have fixed the first part, and Sally is doing the second. Now, all you need is their eSIM on whatever plan works for you. You activate it, and you can use it anywhere in the cricketing world. It helps you save money. It is a global solution to a global problem. Stop fiddling with tiny sims and get the one that does it all. Go to Sally.com Good Areas and use the code Good Areas to get an exclusive 15% off your first purchase. Fly free with Sally. Ian Harvey is probably Dwayne Bravo, isn't he? I think he's a better bowler than Dwayne Bravo, but whether he would have become the professional that Dwayne Bravo did, that was the problems with Harvey, even as a cricketer, you know, smoking and drinking, enjoying a good life. I think he probably had more weapons than Bravo, but Bravo maybe was much better professional than the two of them. I think, though, he was it's weird because Bravo's made a test 100 or two test 100s, three test 100s. Where are we here? So Dwayne Bravo, what's his record in first-class cricket? 100 first-class games, average of 30. And he's got 800s, and three of those are in Test cricket. Ian Harvey doesn't play Test cricket, though. Probably should have, even in that strong period of Australian cricket. He averages 35 with 15 first-class 100s. So, yeah, I would have him as a better bat than Bravo. I think that's fair to say. Also, by the way, Ian Harvey in 54 T20 games, average of 31, a strike rate of 156. Ridiculous. And 52 wickets in 54 games at 23 with an economy of 7.67. So, yeah, I have him as just a better version of Bravo. I think he could bat higher than Bravo. It would be my mean, I think he was a slightly more talented bowler, but as I said, Bravo might have got more out of himself. But I think Harvey was a slightly more talented bowler. But I think Harvey was also a better bat, probably also a better fielder. But again, Bravo, you probably still take Harvey as a fielder. Fascinating, actually. They're quite similar. They're also fifth bowlers who can bowl legitimate four overs a game. And we're talking about Clouston, we're not sure about that. Harvey could bowl legitimately four overs a game, and he would be your death bowler. So he actually plays the Bravo role every way. So I would say he's like Bravo, but a better bat. And maybe you could say Bravo might have worked a little bit harder on his bowling. Harvey was a really good bowler as well. So the thing with Harvey was, I'm not sure if he was ever 100% dedicated to fitness, but he was such a great athlete, maybe it doesn't matter. Because I think Bravo got everything out of himself. A better batting Bravo is probably a fairly good comp for Ian Harvey at his peak. And then you got Chris Harris. Chris Harris, there isn't really another Chris Harris, is there? I rate his bowling quite high as a defensive bowler. Certainly not someone who was easy to knock away. But I think I've looked at his numbers. What's he played in T20s? He averaged 70 in 26 T20s. But he would have been a slow scorer. And I think, he's got a strike rate of 120. And his strike rate in ODIs was 65. His big problem was strike rate. So if we focus back in on his bowling, he's got a great record in the T20s he played. Average of 23, economy of 6.25. ODI cricket 4.28, 37. Yeah, I don't see him as a massively big wicket taker in T20 cricket, maybe other than a couple of periods where people attack him. But he should have been a good defensive bowler. How he fits in with the bat is tricky, though, because there's no spot in that batting order really for him, because I do think he would have struggled to score at the rates that he needed to based on, and I'm a huge fan of him, but based on watching him play over a long period of time. James says, if Zimbabwe had dismissed Kapil Dev cheaply instead of him scoring 175 not out, they would almost certainly have beaten India, given them two wins over Test Nations because they beat Australia in the previous one. Do you think they would have gotten Test status at this point? They should have. I wonder if there might have been thought that it was a bit too close to Sri Lanka. That might have been the only issue, because we're talking 83 and Sri Lanka's just become a Test playing nation, right? So there's maybe an argument that they wouldn't have. But if you beat two teams, I think I said previous tournament, I meant earlier in the tournament. But if you beat Australia and India in that World Cup, Australia wasn't a great side, but India did go on to win it. And so I think if they'd beaten both of those sides, they would have had a good chance of coming in. The other thing I would say is that Zimbabwe was basically a domestic side for South Africa at that point of time. I think by the 90s, there was more of a natural separation of the two. There's still, obviously, even to this day, a lot of links between them. So I'm not saying that's ever going to disappear. But maybe they were seen too much as it's almost like you're playing a first-class team from South Africa at that point. So I don't know if that would have been held against them. I'm trying to think. Yeah, so I think there's some reasons to say it wouldn't have happened, James. But your general point is pretty good, I think, that they were, if they'd won two games in that tournament, it would have been really hard, I think, to not give them test status at that point. They should have beaten New Zealand in the 87 World Cup. I think that's the more interesting one. And in my head, for some reason, I'd already fast-forwarded to that. So I think Dave Houghton plays an incredible innings in that game. Did they end up 3 runs short? I wonder if they'd won that one, because that would have been 83 and then 87. They might have already been a test-playing nation by the time they get to Australia in 92. They didn't actually have a particularly good tournament in 92. They were plucky at times, but, it was that England game, which was on one of the worst surfaces of all time, where they stole test status, right? Like, I think you can argue they should have already been on the way to test status at that point anyway. But they did kind of steal test status by the way they played there, which was, this random wicket in a country town that probably shouldn't have had a World Cup game. Shout out to my Aubrey folks. Sinoy says, do you think Rishabh Pant would benefit from being assigned as a test specialist? His numbers in white ball are weak, and India have enough quality to manage without him in the white ball. I still think he'd be one of the best white ball players in the world. I think we've seen him be, even if it was, a 2 and a 2.5 year period, maybe one of the most destructive T20 players in the world. I think a lot of people got in his head when it comes to T20 cricket. I still think he can be a white ball, an incredible white ball player. I wouldn't throw him away from that at all. Sashmi says, you and many other baseball journalists and fans always bring up the fact that we were one win out of 17 tests prior to Buzz Ball. Do I? I can't remember the last time I brought that up. The stat that I bring up all the time, Sashimi, is a much more fun stat than that, which is that, what, in 2021, the third leading score was extras. That's the stat I do. Why 17? Why not 20? Because England under Root won three consecutive tests against Sri Lanka and India in the subcontinent and pretty comprehensively. Yeah, the one in India was their injuries in that one. Wasn't that a really weird Indian attack? But yes, they did. I thought they played well. I thought Root carried them really well in Sri Lanka. And then Root made the runs in India as well. Out of those 17 tests, 12 were against India, Australia. 8 were in India and 2 and Australia. 2 against... Okay, I'm not going to go through all that. That 17 is an arbitrary number. So is 20, Sashimi. So would 15 be. So would 19. So would 22. 20 is as arbitrary as anything else that you have brought up in this. It's just that we have five things to count on one hand and five things to count on the other hand. And so we have a base test 10 system. And so for some reason in your head, you think that 20 is not arbitrary and 17 is. I think winning one game out of 17, no matter who you play and where you play them, is an issue, as India have been finding out recently, right? Like, I can come up with plenty of reasons why they should have been better. The way they were playing beforehand, it was the whole team was falling down, right? They couldn't make any runs. They had tried a bunch of random things, like Jos Buttler as a specialist number 7, and this whole thing of picking blockers up the order, right? They couldn't take wickets overseas. They needed a shift. If you want a less arbitrary thing, I think I've got this here because I was looking it up the other day. It should still be on here. Yeah, okay. So from the start of Baz Ball to now, England has played 40 test matches and won 25 of them. So the win-loss ratio is 1.9. Really good. South Africa's marginally in front of them, and Australia's quite a bit ahead of them. India is at 14 wins and 13 losses in that time. So you can tell how far back India is there, and a lot of that is recent times, but still, right? So if we go to the 3 years prior, which is 38 matches, so pretty good. As you said, I'm not going to go through and have a look at all the individual series the way that you've done it, just because I don't have time. But they might be slightly different. But you would say over a three-year period, there's a very good chance of it being at least similar. 38 test matches where they won 13. Win-loss ratio of 0.8. So before, they were losing more games than they were winning. And now they're winning almost two times as many games for every one loss. They've basically gone from 13 wins to 25, 26 wins. In a almost exactly the same amount of tests. So when you're very upset with the arbitrary, but this is the best way to look at it. And I've been talking about this for a while. Go and have a look at their record. And what I did was I looked at the 1 year after and the 1 year before, when that was a period of time that was worth looking at. I probably looked at 18 months and 24 months, and now I'm looking at 3 years. What are we talking about here? They're clearly a lot better. That team had issues internally. People weren't particularly happy playing for it. They had no direction, and they're winning a lot more now, right? I still don't think this is a very good team. And, you know, I don't think this is a very good, consistent team. I think they're pretty good at winning games, though, now, and they weren't beforehand. And it would be weird to not say that and have a look at it from that perspective. I would say the recent Pakistan series, the New Zealand one that they ballsed up, and the South African one, which I still think they didn't play particularly good cricket in, as they won at home, still show you that this is not a good and consistent cricket team. They can balls up anything at any moment, and they are a very limited bowling attack, right? Ben Stokes at the moment is having to like pull them back to be good. But if we're comparing them to what they were like before, they had struggled for a long period of time. Though some of those years, 2019 to 2022, that's peak Anderson old man, right? Stokes would have been bowling for a lot of those test matches, and they were averaging 28 runs with the bat, right? They could not make any runs to keep themselves in. To say, and now they're, so it was 28 then, it's gone up to 30. So they're 8 runs better per wicket with the bat than they were before. I think we have to say that Baz Ball has played a part in that. It's all arbitrary, right? You've just decided that 20 is less arbitrary than 17. If they would have won 4 tests out of 20, that's also shit, Sashimi. That's just as shit. Slightly less shit. Lemon says, my big Australian 11, Marsh, Owen, Short, Green, Carey, Hardy, David, Agar, Stark, and Cummins. Hazelwood. Fortunately, Zampa couldn't make the list. Is the current Australian 11 the biggest you have seen? Well, as a society, humans are bigger, aren't they? So I would assume, I mean, you could throw some. So George Giffen? George Bonner is a big fella that used to play for Australia. Warwick Armstrong, Matt Hayden, you know, they've had some big men before. Stackpole was a pretty well-built, Keith Miller was a pretty well-built guy, right? Like, they've had some bigger guys. But yeah, cricket athletes are bigger everywhere, right? Like, in the same way this would be the most cut Indian team, right? Most teams, actually. So yeah, there's a natural progression there. I do think that Australia, probably about 10 or 15 years ago, did identify athleticism as a major thing they were looking for. Maybe they've also been lucky with that, but that was certainly something that I know that they had been discussing for quite some time. Neil says, Washington's batting seems ahead of his bowling at the current development stage. Do you think he pivots and comes around his body enough to help maximize reps? No, I think he's a better bowler than he is a batter at the moment. I think he thinks like a bowler, and when he's batting, sometimes he... Like, there were times watching him in this drawn test, and this is him batting, you know, going to be already his most famous innings, right? And there were times where I was like, get off strike, just get off strike, that's all you need to do here. And he wasn't thinking that way. And that's because he wasn't quite thinking like a batter. But he has lots of natural batting talent. But no, Neil, I definitely don't think he's a better batter than bowler at the moment. I think he's fantastic. What would he be in the best? So Stokes, Bumrah, who's the third best bowler in this series? Like, how far off is Washington? Jofra, Washington, I'm missing someone. Akash, maybe. Siraj, maybe. I don't think he's that far off being the third best. I think he's in the conversation. He may not be it. Nadika says, does Bradman still hold the same place in Australian national identity did in the 20th century? How do the non-cricket playing watching segments of Australian population view him nowadays? No, he doesn't. But even like Bradman was important from a cultural identity point of view in the same way that Sachin Tendulkar and Imran Khan were, right? Struggling nations, finding their way, trying to work out what it meant to be them, right? In a period of time of nationhood where, you know, it's kind of a bit random anyway in some of these sorts of places. So it's a very weird thing. And he comes along, there's a Great Depression, greatest athlete Australia's had. Everyone knows who Bradman is, becomes this big thing. And then it continues to sort of define what Australian excellence is for a long period of time. Australia no longer needs Don Bradman to do that, right? We've had many important politicians and writers and film stars and musicians. So Australia doesn't need to rest, you know, in the same way that Australia, the country, no longer is on the sheep's back, right? Australia, the country, the reputation is no longer on Bradman's back, right? Hugh Jackman is Wolverine, right? You know, what's his name was Thor. It's moved beyond that. Rupert Murdoch owns like big chunks of important things and is currently going to war with Donald Trump, right? Like, it has moved on from that need. But I think it will always represent a period of time in which maybe Australia was starting to become Australia, even if it happens kind of after him. That sort of understanding what defined Australia, I think, comes from Bradman. And so because of that, when you talk about the non-cricket watching playing segments, he's still known as a cultural touchstone at a certain period. To be fair, though, so is the horse Farlap, and it was born in New Zealand. So take that for what you will. Sandeep says, imagine a content creation Groundhog Day. If you woke up 5 years in the past, but with your current brain, how would your content creation journey play out differently? So, I don't really know how to answer that. Yeah, I mean, there are probably things I understand about YouTube now that I didn't understand about YouTube before, so I would do that. If I knew how easy it was to have daily podcasts and constant content, maybe I would have started all that sort of stuff earlier rather than waiting till later. When I started, I don't know, what's 5 years ago? What year are we? I don't even know what I was doing in that year, who I was working for. I think if I went back, the big mistake I think I made was when I left Crick Info, I didn't realize all I was leaving with was a Twitter account and a reputation, right? I kind of felt, wow, all these people, like, if I read a piece on CricInfo and it was good, there might be 50 or 80 tweets where people would tweet about it with my name in the handle, even though that wasn't even, like, they had to find my name. So I just figured that all those people knew what I was doing and so would follow me on Twitter and whatever. And I didn't really realize that there's a disconnect here. So I don't think the 5 years ago was the big argument. I think that it would be like 7 years ago when I was, or 8 years ago, when I was thinking of leaving CricInfo, what I would have actually done is started a podcast, started a YouTube page, maybe even brought my blog back so that when people came over, when I left, there were people already used to going to things. Whereas what happened was when I started again, I had to drag people back. So that was a bit of an issue. I wish I would have understood that longer videos could be done earlier, but people weren't really doing them in cricket. So I didn't know, that you could do multiple podcasts without really ruining your life all that much. I wish I'd known that you could do podcasts on your own like this. And this is still one of our most popular podcasts, even, you know, all the Crick Picks, which is really popular, and Robbie and me, this is still really popular. So I wish I'd just known I could have done this. I would have been doing this for years if I'd known that. Those are the main ones off the top of my head, but you know, I'm sure there's more as well. I don't really worry about shit like that. I'm not being silly. I just keep trying new things. I'm not the sort of person who would ever look back at something like that. Mob says, are South Africa and New Zealand now arch rivals? Oh, I love arch. New Zealand haven't toured South Africa in 10 years. And New Zealand field a few South African ball players. No love lost in knockout competitions. And are now the best of the rest. They've got a really, as you would know, Mob, they've got a really interesting history, right? Because South Africa have just been so dominant against New Zealand for such a long period of time. You know, New Zealand's had some moments against other sides. They really have struggled against South Africa when not in knockout World Cup situations, right? So I actually think it's a really interesting pattern between these two sides. I don't see the arch-rival stuff, but, you know, sometimes you just need, a groundsman yelling at someone and a camera to be there, or it wasn't even groundsman, was it? It was Gambia yelling at the ground. Do you know what I mean? Like, one of the reasons it's harder to have some of these other rivalries is that the media, there's, like, who's the main voice of New Zealand cricket at the moment? Dylan Cleaver has a really successful Substack, but I don't know how many followers he has. I wouldn't have thought it's like 20,000. It might be 20,000. Good on him if it is, but there's no full-time cricket shows or anything. They don't really, haven't really been naming the podcast in the way that the Australians and the English and the Indians have seemed to have moved towards it. Like, how do you stoke all a real thing like this? It's hard without the media to back it up. Sinoy says, during a uni social, I overheard two freshers talking about the IPL and I asked them, do you watch cricket? And one of them said, no, I watch T20. As much as that response aged me and shook me to my core, it did make me wonder if there'll be a time when T20 will deviate so far from tests that people start seeing as two different sports. I think most of us already kind of do. Within the sort of analysis community, there was a point when Subhash and Kartikeya were saying quite a lot that it was a different sport. And it kind of isn't, it isn't. And it still kind of isn't, as it isn't. But I understand what they were trying to say is they were trying to say that you have to think about T20 cricket a completely different way than you do. There are still moments that pull you back and you have to think about it like normal cricket, right? Like the pitch starts to play up and it's good to have first class skills, right, in certain situations, which I don't think Kartikeya always honors. And I think if you talk to players, it's like, yeah, we would love to hit every ball for six, like he says. We can't because this wicket is, you know, being weird. As we start to change players, maybe we will see more sort of Andre Russell, but even Andre Russell can sometimes bat the ball around and he had a first class background as well, right? So I think all three could become different sports to each other. But yeah, it's still cricket. It's always going to be a version of cricket, isn't it? But rugby eventually split from each other. But motor racing is still all kind of linked, aren't they? And kind of always will be, I would have thought. I'm not a big expert on that. But, in my mind, if you can go from racing, I don't know, what, a sort of big, chunky Fords and Holdens in Australia and then go and do Indy and then go and do trucks and then maybe do some formula. Like that kind of tells you that they're all, that's still like motor racing is one sport. That doesn't mean that there aren't going to be specialists who can only do one element of it, like drag racing or something. And it doesn't mean that there aren't other people who will be able to do all of them, but they're still probably under one sport umbrella. But yeah, I would say in the future, there will be just more and more separation. I definitely agree with that. 100%. All right, let us have a quick break. And then when we come back, any comments from the room? Brian Lara used pot plants to work on his placement. John Wright glued his glove to his bat. Sachin Tendulkar dug up practice pitches. Tatenda Taibu cut the top off his bat. Claire Taylor used a hockey grip. Steve Smith was from tennis. Dean Jones would call phantom runs. And Victor Trumper turned the Nets into a war zone to survive. The best batters in the world do whatever they have to make runs. We have told their stories in our new book, The Art of Batting. All right, got a couple of questions here. I saw this one before. Abhishek says, what does false shot percentage mean? From where we can we collect stats like control percentage, average speed in a session? I don't think any of these are public. I could be wrong. Control percentage is something that you can get off Crick Info while the game's going on, but I don't know if that means you can collate it all together. I'm not an expert on how people do stuff like that. But yeah, control percentage or false shot percentage basically mean this ball is being delivered to me and I'm trying to hit it to cover and it goes to mid-wicket, then I'm not in control of where that ball has gone, right? I'm trying to hit this ball and I've not hit it. I'm not in control of this ball at the moment. I was trying to hit it on the ground and I accidentally scooped it up in the air. I'm not in control of this, right? So you can be out when you're in complete control. I think Muhammad Siraj would be the most recent version in the Lord's Test. I'm trying to think if there's any others I've seen of recent times. But yeah, it's a good way of understanding different kinds of players and everything else. It's as flawed a metric as average or any other metrics are, but it does give us a lot of good information and it can be fun to use. You do get players like, I want to say Dean Elgar and Rory Burns, who have a much lower control percentage than other people, but even when they're out of control, they do things to mitigate their mistakes so they're not out. So soft hands or maybe the way they edge the ball or whatever that may be. Whereas you might get another player, like say someone like James Vince, who might have a high control percentage, but when he makes a mistake, you know. So very similar to how we look at maybe a sport like basketball or football. I'm assuming you would have similar situations with players there on different kinds of metrics that are they're similar. Average speed in a session, that's all Crick Viz and Hawkeye, right? And that's completely behind, I was going to say paywall. It's not even, well, I suppose it is behind a paywall. I don't know. I think you can pay to get it, but probably not worth it as a fan. Akshay says, do you believe World Test Championship Final should be a 3-match series with one home, one away, and neutral turf? Yeah. I get this sort of stuff on a day-by-day basis, right? There's 100 ways that you could change this, but it obviously shouldn't be a one-test final. We have enough trouble fitting a one-test final in. The whole system is not working. They're not going to change it. It looks like, if anything, they're going to have two tiers and basically it's going to decide on who those tiers are forever at the moment. Last conversation I've heard. Foxer1 says, I wish to know your thoughts on Syed Anwar's record as a batter. I felt that Pakistan did well when he did well. His World Cup record is stellar. Gil said, I'm reading Jared's book and he has a chapter that starts with Syed Anwar. So I think that tells you I rate him very, very highly. We toyed with the idea of having him in the 50 because I do think he was probably a top 50 level talented player, but his career is so stupid. People complain about selectors now. You need to go back and have a look. So he only plays 55 tests. I do not know how a player of Syed Anwar's talent can only play 55 tests. And he only has an 11-year career as well. And within that, he plays a little bit and then disappears, absolutely blitzes in first-class cricket, I think it is. Yeah, it would be first-class cricket. And then comes back later. It's just bad. Great ODI player, and I don't use that word lightly. I think one of the early adopters to attacking in ODI cricket, probably more along the lines of, don't think he's quite at Sachin's level, although Sachin plays after him. It'd be interesting to see what their overall, I was going to say, the strike. It's probably unfair to do that to Sachin because he plays over a long period of time. But I would have thought that Syed Anwar would have been vastly faster than everyone else in the period where he was opening the batting. He had a strike rate of 80 and for a long time was sort of kind of ignored a little bit. Mark Greatbatch got some attention, and then obviously Jay Asaria sort of takes that over with a little bit of Kalu, but people sort of missed it. Saeed Anwan was doing that for a little bit. Obviously, Sachin was doing it as well. So there was a few of them. I just thought he was a fantastic player, really talented, but ultimately probably not the career he should have had. And I haven't done a deep dive into it, but I remember talking to Usman about it when I was writing the book, right? Because as Arm says, there's a little bit on him. And I did some research, and it was really noticeable how high he was ranked by his peers. You know, I chatted, you know, it was the sort of player I would chuck out to people, and they'd be like, nah, good player, really good player. Like, this guy could bat. And, you know, we worried about him quite a lot. And, you know, Shane Warne talked about that. I think there's a quote by Shane Warne on him in the book. So, yeah, I think he was a really, really good player. Probably, I'm trying to think. I think he probably deserves to go down as much better remembered in one day cricket. Test cricket is a little bit tricky just because he only plays 55 tests. But his numbers really looked, really popped when we had them. I can't remember them all off the top of my head. But it wasn't a long enough era. He didn't play enough tests. But in a tough period, like, the pitches only start getting easier in 2001, and that's when he retires. For an Asian opener to average, what, 45.5? Some of it you have to always remember. You have to factor in Pakistani wickets with all those Pakistani players, just because some of the wickets were great. But he averages 45 in Pakistan and 45 everywhere else. He averaged 47 in 3 tests in Australia. So you can see the problem here. Some of it is just sample. He averaged 42 in England, 57 in India, only 3 tests there as well. 35 in South Africa. I love how even Saeed Anwan couldn't break that for them. And I just want to check draws, because that's the other big thing you have to check with the Pakistani players, although it shouldn't matter as much for him. That's right. This is one of the things that made him pop. I knew there was something about his draw record. This is phenomenal. So he averages 66 in winning games. And that's what part of what Foxhawn is saying here. And he averaged 35 in draws. No one averages 35 in draws, right? That is average a lot more in draws. He almost averages as much in losses as he does in draws, which is really rare. I'm a big fan of him. As I said, he's unlucky. He's certainly one of the greatest top order players that Pakistan have ever had by a distance in my mind. But he's right up there. I just thought he was fantastic. Joe says, between England and Australia at the moment, which side has the bigger flaws? I think England has the bigger flaws because I just don't see how they can consistently take 20 wickets in test matches. They're really good at manufacturing wickets from nowhere, but you'd rather just throw the ball to Pat Cummins, right? Also, at the moment, for them to take the 20 wickets, Ben Stokes has to basically bowl himself to death. So Australia has maybe the more dramatic flaws, but we saw Australia win a test series at home, 5-0, against a good England side, a tired England side, but a good England side, without a top order, with basically Hussey, Paddon, and the tail chipping in over and over again, right? Because their bowling was so good. That's the team I would rather back in that situation. I do oscillate a little bit because the top three is so poor. And England is so good at chipping out wickets that if they could keep cutting the head off of the lineup, and they can chip out the rest. But you still have to face Hazelwood and Cummins. And Stark is looking really good at the moment. I'm interested to see how Boland goes and what Lyon is still doing. But yeah. Saeed says, Karan Nair deserves another chance, don't you think so? Yeah, I didn't think he looked that bad. He just went out. I've seen much poorer runs from players than that. You know, don't want to get too Greg Chappell on this. Sometimes you just get out. I wondered what he would have done on a wicket like this. It is also possible that England have found something in their analysis that domestic teams in India did not. Knowing the state of analysis at the Indian test level, you know, having talked to Himanesh and everything, I wonder if there is, he's pretty negative on analysis within Indian cricket. So there is a possibility that domestic cricket doesn't have as much analysis. And so he's been killing everyone, and now people have worked out how to bowl to him a little bit. But I still thought he looked pretty good before he went out on multiple occasions. It's just hard when you're that age. You get one shot, you know. When Ed Cowan or Adam Voges, like, being successful in your first shot back or your first shot is kind of what you need when you're an older player. Like, I was pretty sure that Chris Rogers would make runs when he came back to test cricket. but also thought if he failed in the first two or three tests, it wouldn't matter. Simon Cattage was another one. I was like, actually, well, I didn't think Simon Cattage would make runs. But looking back on it, if he had failed, I don't think they would have stuck around with him. Once you get over 30, you don't get as many shots, right? So some of it can just be luck. Whereas Sai Sadarshan, that was never going to be the only chance he got, right? Like, he came back, maybe he fails again in later in the series, and they're like, oh, not quite sure about him. They've got some other players, maybe they want to go back to Shreyas Iyer, et cetera, right? But in a couple of years' time, they'll be like, he's still looking good though, isn't he? Let's give him another go. Oh, maybe we can use him in this situation. Karan Nair, I just think it's probably, I don't want to say he's done, he might get another one, but at that age, you don't get many bites of the cherry. You get a single cherry and you have to almost swallow the entire thing to make it work, which is sad but true. All right. Thank you to everyone on the super chats and the regular chats today. We got a couple of regular chats in. We had a bunch of super chats in this morning as well. But thank you to everyone. Remember, Patreon is the best place to support us at Patreon, our Good Errors podcast. But also, if you like the products that our sponsors have, or you want to buy the book, or you want to leave a review somewhere, or a like or a subscribe, all of these things help us to build this network and continue going forward. Forever forward. Occasionally sideways. Mostly forward, I think. Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.